As we prepare to send the kids and more than a few adults out this Halloween evening, we thought it might be interesting to find out what role St. Louis candy makers have played and what goes into that trick-or-treat bag. St. Louis may be known for many things, but candy's right up there. Think of your candy memories: Switzer, Merbs, Bissinger, Crown Candy, not to mention names that may be lesser known, but firmly imprinted on our memories. Joining me in studio for a trip down Sweet Tooth Lane is Suzanne Corbett, an award-winning writer, culinary teacher, and food historian. Suzanne, so nice to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. So what do you want in your Halloween bag tonight?
Whatever you brought. We've got a table full of goodies here, and I'm up for all of it.
Oh, my goodness. We've got all sorts of wonderful things here. But, you know, St. Louis had it was sort of like an epicenter for the Midwest that they shared with Chicago as far as candy makers came and went.
That comes as a bit of a surprise to me, although the names that I mentioned there are very well known and have been around for a long time.
Well, it really shouldn't, because St. Louis is and has been for centuries since its establishment that it is a distribution center. Therefore, you could get a lot of raw materials in here. And when sugar became very affordable, once the Industrial Revolution figured out an affordable way to process sugar, that's when sugar makers were able to connect with those candy makers, and the businesses just blossomed. In 1898, between 1898 and 1914, if you check the business directories in St. Louis, you'll see within that time frame, the Golden Age, that candy producers, confectioners, doubled in size to like over 100 within the city limits.
What kind of a role did candy play beside the obvious? I mean, it was at one time considered something of a luxury, and not everyone could afford it. Or am I wrong about that?
No, it was a luxury because of the cost of sugar.
Yeah.
But that changed once sugar got cheap. And after the Civil War, you'll see more and more of these affordable candies beginning to take hold. I think one of the most fascinating makers was Gustav Golitz, who was in Belleville. Now, he's might be known for a few other things. If you go down the line through his lineage, through his history of his business, but he was the great-great-granddaddy that spurred Jelly Bellies.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because producer Alex Hoyer came in just before the program and kind of hinted that we better bring up Jelly Bellies because he's from Belleville.
Well, what's interesting was that they were never really made in Belleville. Gustav moved the company to Chicago in 1904, and then his sons took parts of the company and moved to the West Coast, which was where the Jelly Bellies were invented. And Jelly Bellies is nothing but a very small jelly bean, as we all know. But what made it different was the infusion of this flavor, intense flavor that they put in the center of it. And that just burst in your mouth when you would bite into them. But panning itself is centuries old also, which is the process of taking something like a Jelly Belly and processing it through what they called panning, which was just more or less like shifting it back and forth in a drum to create a hard candy coating.
You know, the candy makers must have been quite an inventive bunch, because just as you indicated with the Jelly Bellies, there's a wide variety of candy out there and has been for a long time.
That's true. And some of the Halloween things that you always think about, that people say, I'm not going to eat candy corn, that sort of had its beginnings, or I should say its larger distribution here in St. Louis also. Mm-hmm. Gustav, again, before he became into the Jelly Belly back in the 1960s, his claim to fame was what they would call mellow melts, which was soft candy such as candy corn, and candy corn was one of his biggest things that he sold.
This may be getting ahead of the game, but is candy as popular today as it once was? And I'm saying this because sugar has become sort of a villain in the world of the culinary world.
Well, you know, we're all sort of schizophrenics when we talk about how good we're going to eat or how well or this or that.
Yeah.
Everything in moderation. Some of the old classic candy companies that have kind of like died and disappeared or morphed into other things, such as Sunmark, who was the creator of Pixie Sticks and Sprees and Sweet Tarts. They morphed into a company that was Breakers that made the Wonka bars that were big in the 70s, and that's been gobbled up, no pun intended, to Nestle's. Uh-huh. And it's just expanded out through there. The expansion is there. There's more candy out there. There's the variety. There's the health issues that are being promoted that it is good for you.
Yeah. Chocolate being good for you, so they say, which will make my wife very happy.
There you go. It's yeah. got a lot of attributes that are attributed to it.
Yeah. But the whole sugar thing doesn't really seem to be having that much of an impact.
It really doesn't. Yeah. Well, there's an ebb and flow. You know, there was the ban for sugar candies in many different health venues, and which we can get that. But everything, again, in moderation. But you really don't want to have a sugar-free candy if you don't really have to.
Absolutely. Absolutely not. Who was first out of the box here in St. Louis in terms of being a major candy maker? I've looked at a few things getting ready for this program, and I go back to, I think it's 1865, and Switzer seems to be one of the really big early favorites.
Indeed. In fact, Switzer came over. His family's from Ireland. And he began
with a name like Switzer. I would have guessed.
Isn't that
Swiss
funny?
Or yeah.
I know. I saw that and I thought, gee, that's kind of odd. But Switzer began selling his candies along the riverfront in a push cart to help offset the expenses that his family needed because his father died when he was young, and he actually began making more of a caramel, because caramel was huge, almost like it is today, the salt caramel that flies off the shelf. His original claim to fame was his what they called butter melts, and they were a big seller. Then he became known for his licorice. Today, he's still one of the largest producers and well-known brands of licorice in the country.
Are they producing here in St. Louis still?
I believe they are, yes.
I can recall in years past going down in Laclede's Landing and smelling the licorice very, very strongly because of the Switzer building down there.
But Wasn't it grand?
It was absolutely. It was wonderful. The only thing better than that would be chocolate.
Oh, and we have a large chocolate history here.
Well, I've mentioned some of the names that have come up. Bissinger comes to mind. But is Bissinger originally in a St. Louis product?
Bissinger, when he came over, he originally went, I believe it was into Cincinnati. Then a son came into St. Louis. That was established a little bit later on, back in the 40s, I believe. I'd have to double check that. No, I'm sorry. He came over here in 1927. Mm-hmm. And then came into St. Louis.
Cincinnati, was that? It came from another town, as I recall.
Well, they actually came in from France, and then he came when they first settled here. Yeah. They settled elsewhere, just outside of Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. Then his son, Carl, came into St. Louis later on in 1927 and started his operations. But one that's even older than that is Mavrocco. They established themselves in 1904, and they became a very large player here in town, along with other places like Busy Bee, which was another competitor, which actually had a little shop just a few doors down from the studio.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are other names, too. Busy. Merbs?
Merbs. Merbs was founded by an Emma Merb, and that was a company that is still around today. And they're one of those companies that, besides the chocolate, they had their own signature candies that they would do. And as far as I was concerned, it was the only place where you could really get genuine sauerkraut candy. No sauerkraut.
Sauerkraut candy?
Oh, no. Well, it was wonderful. Think of a beautiful, rich vanilla fudge that was just encased with shredded coconut. It was delightful.
So where's the sauerkraut?
Well, they just called because it looked like sauerkraut.
They called it that. Okay.
You know, south side, you got to market to the Deutschman there.
Is there a particular candy or a brand that just blew everybody else away, the most popular St. Louis candy?
I think there was a lot of different candies that were out there that everybody loved. But one candy that really did make a mark here in town and also established the brand across the country was one that really wasn't invented here. But because of the distribution and the mindset of let's do fundraising, was a company called St. Louis Pico Flake, which was part of General Candy Company. Pico Flake, if you haven't ever had it, is peanut brittle with beautiful, long, thin slices of coconut mixed into the batter.
You were nice enough to bring some along with you.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. It's nice and crisp. You can hear it.
Sounds good.
It tastes even better than it sounds. Well, but this became a hallmark for Boy Scouts. Mm-hmm. For their fundraiser. So that kind of went across the country, almost as successful as the Scouting for Food, which originated here in St. Louis.
Right. You also brought some other things along, which look very tempting indeed.
Well, these are chocolate creams and chocolate caramels and chewies and kisses. That kind of represents the chocolate from Merbs and from Mavrocos. And Mavrocos has an interesting story, again, because even though it disappeared, it went out of business, it was bought by the Fannie Mae Company, mm-hmm. the original formula book made its way into the hands of the owners today of Chocolate, Chocolate, Chocolate. Huh. And they love their St. Louis candy history. And these are some of the things that you might have had back in the day. Chocolate-covered cherries and these chewy little kisses, a pumpkin kiss, pumpkin craze was not just limited to lattes and everything pumpkin now. You could look at some of the original flyers from some of these old vintage candy companies and see things like candy pumpkin kisses.
By the way, I think we're going to have pictures of what you did bring today on our website. I know the picture has already been tweeted, so it's out there, folks, if you want to see what we're talking about. Unfortunately, you're not going to be able to taste it, but you can go out and get some. What candy is still being made in St. Louis?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you've got your Switzers again mm-hmm. that's got the main thrust here.
Production.
But all of these candy companies and the new, what you call your artisan candy companies that have sprung up right. are all here and wonderful candies that you can sample.
When I Googled St. Louis candy and St. Louis candy history, mm-hmm. that's the way I do my research, Suzanne, by the way, thanks to Google, almost everything that came up Crown Candy.
Oh, Crown. They're wonderful. Who hasn't been to Crown Candy? It's another one of those wonderful stories of Greek immigrants that brought their candy-making skills mm-hmm. here to St. Louis. They've been around since 1913, and they, third generation, still producing the candy. Mm-hmm. They can have hand-dipped chocolates, chocolate made in molds that they can trace back to their beginning. And it's interesting that those candy companies, particularly like Crown, seem to always partner with ice cream because ice cream, candy always went together. You could market it together, another way to expand your bottom line. And you can still get that wonderful milkshake or sunda along with a half a box of candy to go.
Or a nice BLT if you want.
And a BLT. Well, you know, they began to put luncheonettes in some of these shops, like Crown and Busy Bee also, just to help, again, with the bottom line.
Sure. More traffic.
More ways to sell the product, because if you could get them in for a sandwich, chances are you might be able to have a little bag of something sweet to go out the door
sure.
with them.
You know, I think a lot of us, when we tend to think about the influence on candy, might be thinking in terms of the Swiss. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but is there any kind of Swiss influence in the history of St. Louis candy making?
There could be, but I haven't ran across it. You'll see a lot of German influence, or German candy makers, the Greek candy makers in particular. It was more of an artisan, what you would call today as an artisan trade. You would go down to the candy makers down at Famous Bar who had their own candy kitchens. And those
well
ladies
known.
That were down there, they were taught by grandmothers, their mothers, to know how to dip these chocolates, produce these chocolates. So it was a almost like a cottage industry that expanded out and was embraced by the larger companies like Famous Bar.
You have on my list here, I have the cherry mash also listed. I'm not familiar with that. What is that?
Cherry mash is the thirdest oldest candy bar in the country. Cherry mash, and it's still produced today. It was produced by the Chase Candy Company in St. Joseph, Missouri. So it's got a really strong Missouri connection here. It is a cherry fondant with a lot of peanuts in the center, and then it's enrobed in chocolate. Very decadent at the time. And now it's just an old-fashioned, nostalgic piece of candy that you want to put your arms around. I mean, people from the 30s.
No, you want to eat it. You don't want to put your arms around it.
Oh, well, you want to eat it, but I just embrace it. I mean, I just embrace it and hug it and then I'll eat it.
The Chase Company is one that's popped up more than once in my research. I guess their peanut brittle is also quite well known.
Well, they also made a Pico Flake. And again, many of these companies would make the bulk materials, the bulk candy, to be then packaged and distributed out of St. Louis.
There must have been some point at which individual candies, such as those that you brought here that you'd find in a box of candy, morphed into candy bars because they became popular at some point, obviously. Any idea about when all of that happened?
Well, that all happened, began the late 19th century. Of course, Hershey's got the big play on that because he made the candy bar affordable because he changed the way the candy was made. He changed it in such a way that it made it easier, faster, and therefore more affordable so you could get a great big bar for just a few cents. Mm-hmm. Get a big bar for a nickel. That nickel bar today is probably about the size of a fun size today or less you'd be handing out at Halloween tonight.
The nickel bar is long, long since gone. I remember, I guess it was probably in the 50s or maybe the 60s when Almond Joy and Mounds came out and they had the audacity to charge 10 cents instead of 5 cents for what was the price of a normal candy bar in those days.
Oh, my goodness, those cats.
Where does the chocolate come from? That I mean, a place like Crown Candy, they must buy chocolate in bulk in order to make the product.
Well, it's bulk chocolate, and there's that's produced that then you melt down and temper and do other things with. But chocolate itself is from the cacao plant. Mm-hmm. It's an American, South American, Mesoamerican wonder that the conquistadors took to Europe. They didn't make chocolate as you're thinking of chocolate yourself today. They used it as a drink. It was more of a almost medicinal purpose.
So does it come into the country for use by people like Crown and others in blocks, or is it liquid form?
It can come in a variety of different ways, and there's a lot of issue right now with fair trade rules and considerations on how the cacao is produced and then harvested and processed here in the States. Some are processed abroad, some is processed here, depending on who the candy maker is and what their specifications are.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk about one other thing before we have to say goodbye to you, Suzanne. I know you're involved with Busy Bee Candy and a project to help Campbell House. Why don't you tell us what that's all about?
Oh, that's a fun deal. I was able to have the honor to work on a project with them called The Gilded Table, which represented—
With Campbell House.
With the Campbell House. It talked about all of their culinary history. And one of the huge things that we discovered was that Busy Bee Chocolate was the favorite chocolatier of the Campbells, particularly Hugh would purchase thousands of dollars worth of chocolate. In fact, there is documentation that shows he spent $1,500 for chocolate one year when chocolate was 40 cents a pound. Oh. And he would give it away to most of his friends and to the neighborhood kids, but the poor kids, particularly at Father Dunn's home. But this is a fundraiser that Chocolate has put together, recreated a historic collection of different kinds of chocolates that is then being processed, packaged in historical boxes and such for the holidays as a fundraiser for the Campbell House.
Very quickly, how can people get a piece of the action here?
Oh, just give Campbell House a call or go campbellhousemuseum.org.
All righty. We'll put that information on our website. Suzanne Corbett, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Telling us a little something about chocolate and candy on this most appropriate day, Halloween. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWRU. Listen to the Candyman as we say goodbye. Thanks for listening. I'm Don Marsh.